Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Maxfield, best-selling business author in leadership, influence, and communication. David, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Dave, you've got this amazing background, you know, just an incredible history of success. Can you discuss your prior roles and projects and some key lessons that you wish to pass on?
Sure. I started out as a research psychologist studying personality theory at Stanford University. And I guess I'd say that research is the thread that kind of ties everything, all of my diverse roles together. At various times, I've started organizations and had to close one and been a manager as well as a consultant and writer. I guess I'm co-author of the book Influencer, The Power to Change Anything. And all of my work, I guess I'd say, is based on studying people who find themselves in extreme situations and trying to figure out what it takes to learn to succeed when you're in one of these extreme situations. I guess you ask about some lessons I'd like to pass on. Let me share a few of them. I guess the first one is that bad things happen. They're real, and you need to be alert to them. The bad things can happen to you, and the pitfalls that we fall into are the pitfalls of denial or misinterpretation. What we need to do is accept the facts as they are. So I guess that's rule number one, is bad things happen, you've got to accept it. My second lesson, I guess, that goes with that is that you have to believe in your own hard work, that even when bad things happen, you can afford to be hopeful because many times you can have a greater amount of influence than you might imagine. That at the personal level, we work best if we use failure sort of as a cue to work harder, you know, work smarter, work longer, rather than a cue to give up or to surrender. So that's sort of my second ideal, would be to believe in yourself and your hard work. The third is what is more social. It's find friends, not accomplices. Find supporters, people who believe in you and support you, but you don't want sycophants and you certainly don't want enablers. You need people who can poke you in the eye when you need poking in the eye and tell you when you're fooling yourself. So it's to find friends, not accomplices. I guess the fourth would be to act, to go ahead and act first and adjust later. Don't get lost in thought. Don't pencil whip yourself into inaction. Take some tentative steps. Make sure they're tentative, but take some steps. Then analyze your progress and adjust. So it's a bias toward action. The last, I guess, would be to say, is pick the right problems. I love the Japanese saying that it's better to have the wrong solution to the right problem than the right solution to the wrong problem. So make sure you pick the right problems. And when you've got a problem that you feel is important, one that's really worth solving, then overwhelm it with your influence. The challenge we see is leaders who spread themselves too thin, and our research shows that you're up to 10 times more effective when you focus on just a few key problems or key behaviors and then overwhelm them with multiple different sources of influence.
So those are very, very good tips, and again, based on your incredible history of accomplishment. So, you know, the audience are going to find them very valuable. So now, talking about your prior roles, what are the three most important difficult challenges that you were not able to overcome at that time, and what would you do differently now?
Boy, it's hard to pick the right one. I guess the failure question, it's almost like you're interviewing for a job, right? I guess I can see a couple of familiar patterns in my own failures that probably match some of the patterns that we've been able to follow up on our research. And I guess the first I'll say is when I look back on it and say there have been times when I failed to speak up when I really needed to. Allowing someone else. I mean, I'm often in the role of the consultant or an advisor, and I must say that when any of us is in that role, if you allow someone to fool themselves about a problem or to implement a solution that's really just a paper tiger, it just looks like a solution, you're not doing them any kind of favor when you let them do that. So let me give an example. Early in my career, I was working as a consultant to a large automobile manufacturer here in the U.S., and about the fourth trip there, I was in a conversation with a senior leader, and I used what he referred to as the P word, productivity. It was an undiscussable. I was talking about how I saw people at all different levels in the organization and different parts of the organization not doing what I considered to be an honest day's work. I saw people reading newspapers, playing games on their computers, doing a whole variety of things other than being engaged and focused on the job. And it became very clear, not only talking with this senior manager, but at the same time I was working with union local presidents across a variety of different automobile manufacturing facilities, and it was the dirty little secret that everybody knew, but that nobody could acknowledge, was the poor productivity throughout the industry, not just among frontline employees, but among managers and leaders. And both sides would tell me not to discuss it. And as a result, I'd find myself working around the edges of this giant gaping chasm, kind of like fixing hangnails on a heart attack patient. Right, so I guess that's one of those areas where I wanted to devote a lot of study and say, how can we help people speak up when they're in that situation where no one really wants to hear what they have to say? It's an undiscussable, the emperor has no clothes, but you can't move forward unless you discuss it. So that would be a kind of a mistake that I've certainly made, and I hope others can relate to that. I guess the second mistake is to look at a problem as being more simple than it really is and end up applying a simplistic solution to a complex problem. The kinds of problems that I focus on in my research are problems that we describe as profound, persistent, and resistant. By profound, we mean they're those kinds of problems that are really, truly worth solving. My father has a saying that if a thing is not worth doing at all, it's certainly not worth doing well. And so these are issues that are worth doing and are worth doing well. And by persistent, we mean problems that have been around for a while. They're endemic. They've built up. They aren't just an accident or a one-time response to an external challenge. They're part of who you are or part of the organization's culture. And by resistant, I mean they're durable problems. They're problems that you've tried to solve, but they've just come back. Now, what we've found is when you're facing a persistent and resistant problem, what makes it persistent and resistant often is that it has multiple root causes. It doesn't have a single root cause, so we end up going after a single root cause with a simplistic solution, and the problem returns because of the other root causes. So here's an example. I was working with a hospital emergency room, several emergency rooms in a hospital system, where caregiver burnout was the problem. Physicians and staff were emotionally exhausted all the time. It was beginning to turn to cynicism, backbiting, blaming the patient, some of the other hallmarks of burnout. And we had in advance pinpointed some circumstances that we felt would drive the burnout. Certain crucial conversations, certain crucial moments when the situation would pivot from success to failure. And so we were going to focus on those crucial moments, and we were looking at using a training intervention to give people skills to handle those crucial moments. Well, fairly quickly, it became clear that training, while one source of influence, was not going to be nearly enough. They needed some very specific operational improvements that were beyond the organization's immediate bandwidth. And we had to recognize that training as a simplistic solution was not going to make anything better. If anything, it might even make things worse. So I've fallen into that trap. I think it's probably a familiar one to people.
So those are great stories and examples. I can see why you're this featured keynote in so many conferences, because you can relate to the situations that are out there, provide real-world solutions and examples that people can really, feel connected to.
Thank you.
What were the key disruptive forces driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experiences?
Well, I can share a few. Let me comment on your question just a little bit. I think it's an interesting question in that so many of the changes that we have are gradual, evolutionary, they're planned, they feel like they're within our control. And yet, if we're honest with ourselves and we look backwards and say what influenced our lives, so many of them were unpredictable, bolts from the blue, these disruptions that change us. And I think that when we handle them correctly, they become defining moments, and they define who we are. They may even become transformative moments and change who we are. In fact, even if we don't handle them well, they become defining moments. In fact, maybe even more so, especially if we, lose our temper But let me share an example. This goes back a long ways. Let me go back to when I was like 12 or 13 years old. So I'm in like junior high or middle school. And like many kids these days, I was in a middle class family that devoted a lot of attention to me. My parents invested in lessons for me, in sports, in music, in education, you name it, right? It was all about building my skills, making me better, right? Me. Well, the summer after about the eighth grade, my parents told me in kind of a celebration, you're now an adult sort of way, that I was now skilled enough to start giving back. And I didn't even know really what they were talking about, except that it was going to totally disrupt my summer plans. but they were pretty adamant, and they gave me plenty of options, things to consider. And I ended up that summer deciding to take a volunteer job with UNICEF, the UN's program for children. And the job that they had for me was retrofitting a building in a very rundown urban part of Kansas City, Missouri. It needed to be retrofitted enough so that VISTA volunteers could move in and work there. And it was going to take a little over a month. I'd be living away from home, working as a team, as part of a team. And I have to tell you, I loved it. It was one of those transformative experiences where I learned to be independent. But I think most important, I learned that I was worth something, that I really could contribute. So here's sort of the takeaway that I'd want people to think of that worked for me. And I've seen it work with other young people, but adults as well. The point is that our own self-esteem, our own sense of self-worth has to be earned. It doesn't come from being skilled, from being accomplished, even from being the best. It comes from worthy accomplishments. It comes from giving to people, from helping others succeed. So whenever there's an occasion when we can put ourselves in a situation where we're responsible for someone else's success, I think that's a time that defines us, that helps us to grow, and I think is an important part of being who we are. Now, let me give maybe a very quick different example. This is maybe one that a lot of us can relate to, and it's that just in the course of my career, I went to college in the second half of the 1970s. I went to my graduate program in the late 70s, early 80s, and think of the technology disruptions that were happening at that time. For me, I was in psychology, personality theory. We basically study rats, perverts, and sophomores, and I was interested in interpersonal skills, communication skills, how to handle strong emotions, how to deal with those kinds of situations, and all of a sudden, video was available. Not only was it available, it was cheap. And my job changed from writing theory to writing scripts. It forced psychology to take skills all the way down to the level of what would you say, what would you do, how would it work. And these technical innovations have continued to drive our work in just radical ways. We experiment with blogging. We put videos up on YouTube pretty often. We have a newsletter, an opt-in newsletter with 108,000 subscribers. If the technology just creates opportunities we would never anticipate and have to jump to keep on top of. So it's just exciting.
Well, it sounds like you've always taken this opportunity to see change or disruptive forces as seeds or catalysts to move you forward in terms of your learning or in terms of insight or maybe even just growing your skills in some way.
I hope so.
You know, can you profile your current roles and work and the value delivered to your diverse audiences?
Yes. I have three main roles here at Vital Smarts, as a consultant, a researcher, and a writer. As a writer, I'm co-author of one of our books, Influencer, The Power to Change Anything, as well as co-author of a variety of research studies. Probably the one that is getting a lot of press right now is an MIT Sloan study called How to Make Change Happen, and here's what we found. We found that some senior leaders are 10 times more successful than others in leading change in their organizations, and the key here is that they apply multiple sources of influence focused on just a few vital behaviors. Let me share a little bit more detail on this one. It was actually three research studies sort of boiled into a single article. The first study was looking at leader-led change, things like implementing an enterprise-wide software system, or making a large human resource kind of change, or managing a merger or an acquisition. So those were the first category, were leader-led change. The second category were issues that involve, I'll describe them as below-the-waterline challenges, so sort of cultural, social challenges inside an organization, so a culture of poor accountability, or a culture of rigid bureaucracy that doesn't allow for much innovation, or a culture of poor customer service, or even a culture of poor work ethic. So how to deal with those kinds of challenges. The third area was outside organizations altogether. It dealt with personal habits. So how to deal with challenges related to fitness, weight loss, addictions like smoking or drinking, spending challenges, so personal challenges. And in each case, we had a very simple hypothesis. The hypothesis was the more different sources of influence you bring to bear on the problem, the more likely you are to be successful. Sort of common sense. Now, what we found was that only 5% of the leaders and individuals in our sample, it was a huge sample, well over 2,000 leaders, combined four or more sources of influence. So, and the ones who did combine four or more sources of influence were, depending on the domain, up to 10 times as successful as those who used just one or two. And so I guess it proves that common sense is pretty uncommon. So the kind of value that we try to deliver to the different audiences we work with, whether that's in organizations, whether it's in senior teams, whether it's through our training or through our books, is how do you identify these problems that are worth solving, the profound, persistent, and resistant ones, and then how do you organize sources of influence into a comprehensive, overwhelming, powerful strategy? That's what we work for.
In your current role, then, what are the biggest challenges and their solutions like, and how does this relate to business?
I think I'm going to have to try to categorize things a little bit because there's so many challenges. I'll group challenges into three categories based on how I end up spending a lot of my time. The first would be challenges within senior teams. So this would be consulting with a group of, 6 to 12 individuals, a leadership team that may be struggling with politics, with low levels of trust among each other, with each other, or hidden agendas. We're trying to identify, are there undiscussables that are under the table? Are there elephants in the room that, as a group of individuals, we can get out on the table, we can talk about, and together devise a solution? So that's a very personal kind of a challenge that we end up working with. The second would be challenges that are organization-wide. So these challenges that reflect stubborn cultural practices or social norms, things like poor accountability, silos in your organization, poor customer service, that sort of thing. The third area is very broad, and I'll describe them as social problems. So an example would be a phone call that I got last week from a medium-sized town on the West Coast where they've had three teenagers throw themselves under trains. Three from the same high school, and four more attempted. So we're talking an epidemic within this town of teen suicides, and looking at how would we look at the combination of the tools that Vital Smarts has, crucial conversations, and influence strategies to combine together to help a town, to help its young people, to deal with a social challenge. Other similar kinds of challenges are a state where the teachers in the state have become self-insured and have got a renewed interest in helping themselves become more physically fit, to lose weight, to exercise more, because now they've got a bit of skin in the game beyond just personal. So this whole realm of social problems that are in some ways the most fulfilling of all, because you feel like you're making a very substantial difference. So I guess those are the kinds of challenges that we've been going after. And you'd asked about their solutions. Let me give, because I can't give, these are complex, and I can't give an immediate solution, but let me give some steps that I take just to get started. The first is I look for what in our jargon, in the literature, are called positive deviants. It's the time when you want to be the deviant. A positive deviant is someone who ought to have a problem, but who doesn't. So if you're living in an area where most people are kind of burnt out, like in an emergency room, but you find three or four who are not, who are coping just fine, look for those positive deviants and study them. As you're studying them, the second thing I'll do is we'll look for crucial moments, moments or circumstances when performance pivots from good to bad or from bad to good. So in a crucial moment, what is it the person does that heads them toward burnout or away from burnout? And then as we're looking at these crucial moments, the third thing I'll try to identify are what we call vital behaviors. So what are two or three behaviors that make a difference in these crucial moments? Sometimes they're obvious, but many times they're somewhat hidden. And then finally, try to develop a comprehensive influence strategy combining all six sources of our influence model aimed at just those two or three vital behaviors. So that's the approach I'll take. With something like the teen suicide issue, we're really just getting started. But as you can imagine, I'll be looking for crucial moments, moments in a teen's life when they are suddenly at risk. And at least I've been poring through the literature, times of drug and alcohol abuse, times of big fights with parents, big fights with loved ones, like girlfriend, boyfriend, a failure at school or at work, okay, crucial moments. And then what do we need that to happen in that crucial moment? What can those of us who are loved ones or bystanders, what do we need to do when we know that a teen is in that situation? What does the teen need to do when they're in that situation? What differentiates success from failure? And then we'll be working with this, with the whole city and the whole community to develop a comprehensive influence strategy.
If we were to expand this sort of idea to sort of what's happening globally, you know, we hear about the economic challenges both in North America but worldwide. Well, how can we improve the ability of companies to survive?
Well, we've been doing research on a particular part of this problem, and I don't want to pretend to be, you know, have expertise that's very broad. What we've been looking at is what we're calling financial agility, the ability of a firm, and particularly the senior leaders of a firm, to respond rapidly and effectively to financial shocks or changing economic conditions. And so following the strategy I was just describing, we look for crucial moments, and we've found four crucial moments that predict with really incredible precision how quickly and how successfully a firm can respond. In fact, what we found is the teams that master these four moments are five times more likely to respond within days or weeks rather than months, and they're 10 times more likely to respond in ways that position the firm for future success rather than making cuts that end up hurting its potential. So the four crucial moments that we found, we've put some labels on them. The first one we're calling debate, dithering, and denial. So it's your a financial crisis or an economic shock is happening, and rather than responding to it, we're telling ourselves stories about how maybe it's not as bad as we think, or maybe it's not really happening, maybe we don't, and we're really just denying it rather than confronting it. The second is when an organization has undiscussables, when the senior team knows it's in a financial shock and several people on the team feel that they know what ought to be addressed in order to respond, but they're thinking that the thing that has to be addressed is a sacred cow or somebody's pet project or some other kind of undiscussable. And so rather than confronting it and dealing with it, they're dancing around it, they're avoiding it, they're allowing the undiscussable to continue. Now the third is a little bit like it, but has a little bit different character. We call it silent collusion. And here's an example of how this happens. The senior team gets together, they recognize that they're facing a shock, and they recognize that some pretty profound action has to be taken, and in fact, they agree on what the action is. So here's an example. I'm working with a senior team. They agree that they've got to cut expenses quickly and dramatically, and one of the steps they decide to take is to cancel all consulting contracts and other outside vendor contracts and to not move forward on them. And so I'm interviewing the vice president of the Japanese region, and he says, we had this meeting at corporate. 2 weeks later, we're back in our regions, and I see my peer in, I think it was Singapore, has extended a consulting contract, the very thing we had promised not to do. So I asked the guy, the president of the Japanese affiliate, well, did you hold him accountable for it? Did you talk to him? And he said, no, I waited to see what corporate would do. I said, okay, and what did corporate do? He said, well, corporate did nothing. I said, okay, what did you draw from that? And he said, well, I'll tell you, I extended some of the contracts in my own area. And so the silent collusion ends up being I won't call you on your commitments if you don't call me on my commitments. And so I end up not holding you accountable, you don't hold me accountable, and our commitments become hollow. Now, the final of these four crucial moments is kind of a response to the first three. When the leader in the room sees this debating and denial going on, sees undiscussables being avoided, starts to see some silent collusion going on, they end up deciding to just slash across the board. We call it irrational slashing. It's where, I'm betting all of us have seen it, where rather than take a measured, reasoned response, we simply take a blanket approach to everybody cut 10% or everyone cut 15% where it's imposed, it's top down, it's across the board, and what our research shows is it has a 50-50 chance of damaging the company's long-term ability to thrive. And that when the leader ends up cutting out his or her team and resorting to this irrational slashing and kind of out of desperation, really, they're 2.5 times more likely to cost the firm millions of dollars in potential savings that the team, if they'd been fully involved, would have been able to identify. So what we focus on, what we ask people, what we work with senior teams on, is how to identify these crucial moments and plan for accelerated decision making when they recognize these moments, and to develop scenarios and actually hold fire drills.
You know, you do a lot of research, and you must look at sort of the relationships between major financial adjustments and human behavior. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think this is less my research and more the evolving field, I think, that we're in. For years, economists have built models that are based on this model of a rational human being. And we can all sort of snicker at it because we've all met some few of us who aren't so rational. But the assumption has been that overall, people will respond to changing economic conditions in a completely rational way, as if, on average, people would behave as if they were computers. Now, unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, this rational assumption has not held up to current data. And so you see a whole new discipline within economics called behavioral economics. And it uses what we know about human thought and about human behavior to understand how people are likely to react to financial adjustments and financial crises. Suffice it to say, we're not entirely rational. For example, we don't see patterns very well. We tend to invent clever stories and excuses to explain away the data that we don't like. We tend to follow the crowd. We tend to deviate from rational in all kinds of ways. Often, the best description of a human response to economic conditions resembles a catastrophe curve. So we ignore or deny a pattern of change until a crisis occurs. And the crisis crystallizes the pattern for us. All of a sudden, the pattern becomes visible. We wonder how we've ever missed it. In fact, we end up blaming other people for why they missed it. And we tend to overreact. Now, let me add some positive to this negative. There are organizations that, because of the environment they work in, have become especially good at recognizing and reacting to change. And the term that's been given them in the literature, and this is the literature, I guess the senior researcher and leading thinker in this area is Carl Weick at University of Michigan, calls them highly reliable organizations. An example would be a forest fire fighting team, or teams that handle the deck of an aircraft carrier, where accidents are especially likely and especially costly. And what they find is that if you want to be good as these highly reliable organizations, you need to have a few characteristics. You need to have a preoccupation with failure. So you expect failure, you're looking for it. And when you see it, you accept it and deal with it. Second, a reluctance to simplify. So when you see the messy world happening around you, you don't look for a single root cause. Again, you look for multiple root causes. Third is what Weick calls a sensitivity to operations, meaning you're always trying to have situational awareness for what is the real world situation happening in real time. I like to think of this as sort of a difference, a huge mind shift for leaders. It used to be that if we looked at a leader's job and said a leader's job is to analyze, predict, and control, it's all about trying to think for the future, trying to anticipate out long-term into the future and plan for that. What Weick is talking about is the analogy would be what's happening in an aircraft carrier. And the captain of an aircraft carrier may not care at all what's happening 2 hours from now, but care very deeply about what's happening in the next 15 minutes, but needs to extend his or her eyes and ears and hands a thousandfold in order to comprehend all the different things happening on the aircraft carrier or within a 15-minute range of the aircraft carrier in a single moment. So while the model of a leader predicting the future, you could think of a leader sitting by themselves trying to analyze the future, a leader in a highly reliable organization needs to have hands and fingers in real time all over the place trying to maintain situational awareness. Now, the next couple elements, the fourth element is what White calls a commitment to resilience, which means we know we're going to fail. We need to be able to analyze and adjust on the fly. And finally, a deference to expertise over authority. So understanding that in today's complex world, the expertise is often whoever's closest to the customer, whoever's closest to the problem, rather than who has the most training or who has the most authority. So it's a deference to expertise, and understanding that expertise includes more than just training and education. It includes real-time information.
Now, we've already touched on this already, and you talked about it in some of your other responses, but can you summarize again the conditions and practices that allow an organization to respond well and with agility to economic threats?
Yes. The four conditions I was looking at were, the first condition is one that I'd summarize as denial. So an organization that is quick to recognize a failure or recognize a setback, and rather than explain it away, address it and handle it, deal with it. The second is an organization that does not have a lot of undiscussables. There are no elephants in the room. So when something happens that is bad news or that violates our assumptions of who we are, we talk about it, and it's made public so that information is brought above the table. So unlike the automobile firm I was talking about, that couldn't talk about productivity, you talk about these issues. The third is everyone holds everyone accountable for everything. There's no silent collusion. That in hospitals where I work, a healthy healthcare team is one where any nurse or technician can ask a physician to remember to wash your hands. Anyone can speak up. And the final is that when you as a senior leader feel yourself giving up on the team, saying, this team is not going to take action, I'm going to need to take action, even though I know it's less than optimal action, rather than resort to irrational flashing, confront the team and confront the problem, the denial you're seeing, the undiscussables you're seeing, the lack of accountability you're seeing, and demand that the team be involved. So those are the four circumstances. And those teams, those senior teams that are able to handle those situations, again, are 5 times faster in their response and 10 times more successful.
Well, that's an excellent summary and very useful to the audience members. You know, if we were to broaden this, you know, what are the most important broader business solutions and business challenges?
Boy, that's another big question. Let me divide them into a couple categories, sort of external factors and internal factors, where the external factors, at least short term, is a weak economy. Debt, financing, consumer confidence, clearly a huge challenge. Longer term, the global interdependence that we're all a part of, it's a powerful source of, or a powerful force for good. It also raises some very challenging issues. We have incredible gaps between the haves and the have-nots, and yet everyone is getting access to information, and makes the disparity between the haves and have-nots all the more intolerable and unacceptable, and we'll have to deal with this. I think there's a huge challenge around education. On the one hand, education is becoming democratized across the world, but at the same time, the gap between the education haves and the education have-nots is becoming dangerously large. And finally, I guess I'll just sort of summarize this. How do we rationalize our organizations, as we look at how we our operations, how our value change creates value. If you look at raw materials, if you look at knowledge, if you look at manufacturing, even financing and customers, all of this has become far more global. So imagine your raw materials come from Chile, your intellectual property comes from India, your manufacturing is done in China, and your financing is maybe coming from China, and your customers are global. How do you site your organization? How do you develop your supply chain? How do you put in your value-adding processes in a way that rationalizes that global situation? Now, those are all external factors. The internal factors, I guess, are perhaps, to some extent, responses to these external. But I see the huge internal factors as how do we improve responsiveness? How do we maintain common purpose across silos, across regions, across separate companies that cooperate? And related to all these, how do we execute on plan? How do we take project management and have it become effective 85% of the time rather than missing schedule 85% of the time? And more broadly, how do we develop the next generation of leaders?
And I guess the solutions really are embedded in some of the services that you're offering through Vital Smarts as well.
Well, to some extent. I think that a common solution across all these problems is open, frank, and timely dialogue. That as long as we can maintain dialogue about these problems, we can perhaps make progress.
Do you see a role for government in some of these challenges and their solutions?
Yes, I do. I think that government can play lots of different roles. There are times when government can take risks that private enterprise is unable or unwilling to take. Obviously, there's a greater resiliency on the part of government. I think that when we look at the gaps between the haves and the have-nots, I think that the taxation system often sets up incentives that can either drive a wedge there or bring people closer together. I think that we need safety nets, clearly, that you'll get a citizenship that's far more willing to take risks and be innovative and entrepreneurial when there's a safety net that people can rely on. So I definitely see a role for government.
In the different discussions that you've had in the past, but also in our dialogue here today, you've talked about different elements of behavior and about leadership and so forth. So in terms of your analysis and your research, what do you see as the key trends that are redefining leadership?
Well, some of them I guess I've mentioned already. The globalization and globalization not just of raw materials or manufacturing or customers, but globalization of where intellectual property is created, you know, where capital comes from, and then how to get global efficiencies. Another trend, which I guess is a broader trend, is that we are more and more overwhelmed with data, that we don't necessarily understand how to turn into actionable information. I was reading a New York Times analysis of the healthcare debate in the U.S. that's going on, and they were quoting how Lyndon Johnson was able to get some massive parts of Medicare and Medicaid passed because there were no economic think tanks developing projections that people trusted or that people used. Today, there are multiple overlapping and competing economic projections. There's so much data that it can leave us unable to act if we're not careful. It becomes data being used for political ends rather than as pawns, more or less, rather than as being used for actionable information. Another obvious one, I guess, is the need for greening of our industries and of our organizations, especially around energy considerations, the carbon footprint that we have, the issues related to global warming, and of course, over the horizon, all the issues related to water. In some parts of the world, water is already a crucial natural resource that wars are fought over. That's likely to become more and increasingly the case in many different ways, and of course, global warming ties into that as well. When you start to see low-lying countries like Bangladesh or Vietnam start to sink below the seas, those people are going to migrate, and we'll need, as a world and as societies, to figure out how to handle that. And believe me, that's going to take some leadership. I guess the final area would be as leaders, I think we've tended to neglect the bottom 80% of the world population, and yet it's a huge market, it's a huge requirement. And so you see micro-enterprise succeeding, and the micro-banks like the Grameen Bank being so incredibly successful, both as an economic force, but in raising people out of poverty. I think, again, great leadership needs to be pointed towards and will be rewarded for focusing on the bottom 80% of the world.
Okay, so you've actually talked about sort of the forces that are impinging on leadership and redefining leadership. Then what are your predictions about what leaders should be in the future?
Well, very interesting. I mean, I think that it's becoming more and more the case that we need to be true to our values and our purpose and flexible in our strategies for obtaining those purposes and values and creating resiliencies. So I would imagine that as our customers, our suppliers will become increasingly fractioned and that we will need increasingly networked leadership so that if I'm a leader at a corporate headquarters, I need to have leaders throughout the organization, throughout the world, in regions and functions, being able to take independent action and yet coordinated action that is all around and towards a single purpose. And I hope technology will help this networked sort of leadership. I think the leadership needs to look like the nodes on the computer networks, where it's resilient and taking down any single node doesn't take down the firm. And also incredibly inventive in the same way that you see shareware developing in dramatic ways. We need leadership to be amenable to that so that strategy is shared strategy. And so I'm guessing that's what I'm looking at as a business leadership trend, call it network leadership maybe.
Do you see the schools, the different MBA programs and graduate programs and supporting these kinds of trends, or are they in sync?
Well, I don't usually expect business schools to lead trends, but more to create, I guess there are two things. One is there's an extent to which business schools try to create leaders, these well-rounded people who have a sense of purpose, some interpersonal skills, and a variety of tools, and throws them into the breach, having no idea what those leaders are going to need to face, and that's reality. The other approach is the more technician or technical approach, which is kind of less like creating leaders and more like creating the advisors to leaders. And you'll see some programs, very elite programs, turning out high-end consultants who are very talented within a specific narrow range of tools. And I think both kinds of talents are needed, but I'm not sure how leaders are going to become these network leaders. I think there'll be a lot of exploration once people are out of school.
And as you indicated, maybe tying into some of these social media trends or...
Yeah, exactly.
Or the millennial groups, right?
Right.
Shaping attitudes in the future.
Yeah, I think so.
So what are your top recommended resources and why?
I guess I'll go to the resources that I find I use the most. I use my customers probably the most. I learn more picking brains from smart people who are in the middle of interesting problems and just getting ideas from them and moving from there. The second would be, I'll say I learn a lot from competitors. And often these competitors are also partners. We do a lot of collaborative work. And anyone who's facing similar challenges that I'm facing, I want to learn from. I want to benchmark against. And then I guess, you know, you got to throw in sort of the internet, whether it's Google or Bing or one of the other search engines. I find myself accessing search engines 20 or 30 times a day just trying to find who's doing what. And I'm very quick to then follow up with an email or even a phone call when I find a person who's making progress in an area that I'm interested in.
Do you see this sort of value in crowdsourcing then?
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, there needs to be some sort of a function so that it's not just whoever talks the loudest gets in. I love the work that's been done on predicting political campaigns, where if you ask people who would you like to have win, that's not a very accurate way to predict who's going to win. But if you ask people who do you think is going to win, and there's money riding on it, so they have to pay a certain amount of money to put their prediction in, and they get a certain amount of money if their prediction works, that's very successful. So like some of the sites, the internet sites that focus on innovation, where you have to pay $20 or $50 to submit your idea, and other people judge your idea, and if they can make that idea successful, they win part of the payout. As soon as you start adding economics to the whole matter, I think things start to get a lot more interesting as people put skin in the game. They're not just talking.
So it sounds like you're a supporter of predictive markets.
I am, absolutely.
You know, you've got this incredible background, as I mentioned before, just long history of success. So you must have some interesting stories you can share.
Yeah, but should I? I don't know. Let me share kind of an example of an organization doing the right thing. I was working at a large hospital, and while I was working there, a helicopter crashed on their roof. And as you can imagine, that it threw the day into a catastrophe. Fortunately, no one was killed, but they could very easily have been killed. And the senior team dropped what they were doing and took charge. And they took swift action, and by the end of the day, the situation was pretty much, you know, buttoned up, until one of their directors came to see the CEO. She came in kind of flustered and said, I need to talk to all of you on the senior team, and I need to talk to you before you go home tonight, and was adamant about it. The CEO called his team together and said, okay, what is it? And she said, I am licensed by the Federal Aviation Association to take charge of emergencies in this healthcare system, and you didn't let me do my job. You took over. And there are all kinds of horrible things that could have happened. And as she said this, they described her as quivering in fear. She knew she was about to lose her job. At the end of the discussion, the CEO said, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. We screwed up. And help us understand what we should do different next time. And then went public and shared how the senior team had violated its own best interests, and how a director with the gumption and the values stood up and confronted them and helped them see that they had made a huge mistake, and then thanked her and made a hero out of her for being the kind of person who speaks up when they see something that's going wrong. And that's, I guess, that's the healthy reaction that I look for in an organization. And the reason I tell it as a story is because it just doesn't happen as often as you wish it would.
Now, David, do you blog?
I've gone back and forth. Yeah, I contribute to our blog. We have a newsletter that goes out to about 120,000 subscribers. And so I write as part of that. I had a blog that I did just on my own for a couple years that I didn't get enough of an audience for, and so we've kind of just meshed it into the newsletter.
So it's your communications vehicle for getting your messaging out in terms of these stories and best practices and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's very, there are blogs that I read pretty religiously, yep.
Well, David, I'm going to turn this around now and saying you're the interviewer. You know, what questions have I missed that I should have asked you, and then what will be your answers?
You know, I don't think I have any to add here. I think you've done a great job, and that you've created a platform where I've been able to share ideas that I hope people find valuable.
Well, we've covered a broad spectrum, and you've gone into sort of analysis of certain scenarios for corporations, which can lead to them getting into difficulty, and you've even launched into things like the long tail, perhaps, right? You know, enabling the 80% that are not empowered at this point, and all the different kinds of things that can be done, or some of the symptoms that can be looked for in terms of healthy organizations and organizations that aren't healthy. You talked about leadership and business trends, and just an amazing discussion. I thank you for taking this time. And, you know, David, we'll continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions, and we indeed thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen. It's been a real privilege.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with David Maxfield, best-selling business author in leadership, influence, and communication.